a woman who had moved to Varnamtown, North Carolina. She was actually an organic soap tycoon, had moved there to retire and then had heard these stories about some of the local inhabitants. And she passed that on to my friend about this small town where she had moved that in the 80s. And this is a small coastal town in North Carolina of about 300 people. And in the 80s, they had done a deal. The town had done a deal with Pablo Escobar as an importation hub for drugs, for what he was smuggling into America. So marijuana, cocaine, crates, this kind of thing. And they brought the shipments in by sea and by air into this little community. And I said, that is crazy. How does that happen? How do you make that contact, first of all? And I said, I need to know more about this.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. That is Kyle MacLachlan, terrific actor who has a really cool podcast called Varnamtown with director Joshua Davis. And it's based on this small town in North Carolina that Pablo Escobar used as a staging area to deal drugs all over the country. And it's just a crazy story. And we get into a really cool conversation about their investigation and how that all came about. So really, really fun conversation. Before we get to the show, I want to do a couple of things and thank everybody. We sold out the United Theater in Westerly, Rhode Island, beautiful theater, for my show, Permission to Speak, my Broadway show directed by Frank Oz. That is animation by J.J. Settlemyer, who did Beavis and Butthead and all the SNL TV Funhouse cartoons, among other things. Really cool set by Jim Fenhagen, who is a set designer for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, where I work now, and has done it's got 23 Emmy Awards. He's brilliant. And really lucky to be collaborating with these guys, and we're having so much fun doing it. And the show's been great. We're sharing stories. People come on stage. I randomly pick audience members, and the premise of the show is we all have a story to tell. And if we tell stories, maybe we're not so divisive and we realize we have more in common than we think. Not a political show, but just a really cool, fun show. So hope you guys can make it out, because we got other shows coming April 6th at the Marcus Center in Milwaukee, April 20th at the Tarrytown Music Hall in Tarrytown, New York, just outside of New York City. We're going to be at the Al Larson Theater August 23rd, just outside of Chicago in Schaumburg, Illinois, and then the following night in Indianapolis. So go to my website, paulmercurio.com, check it out, tell your friends. We got more dates that we're adding, and it's just really been fun. Plus, I'm also doing stand-up on the road, so come on out. On a personal level, I took an Uber and I noticed in the Uber app, there's a button you can hit that says no conversation with the driver, so that if you don't feel like talking, you don't have to. I'm having that button installed on my forehead, and it'll say no conversation. And that way people can hit the button and know that I am not talking to them. I just can't make small talk anymore. I don't know what it is. I've talked about this before. I'm working on a welding helmet, a fashionable welding helmet. So I have my helmet up, and then I get on an elevator or something, and you start chit-chatting with me, and I just flip, boom, put the shield down. Pretty much tells you everything you want to know. Don't want to hear your story. Don't want to hear about your kids' ice skating escapades. I don't want to hear about all the cool things your dog does, or just don't want to hear it. I'm just getting older, I guess. And I'm not old, but just like, hey, I can't take it. I can't fake it anymore. Oh yeah. You know, your son. Yeah. He's a great baseball player. I would rather literally throw myself in front of a bus. So I'm going to market this button and hopefully sell it and make some money, but really it's just about peace of mind. I could use a break from everybody. All right. Enjoy Varnamtown. It's a really cool conversation about this this crazy story. And I hope to see you guys out on the road for my Broadway show, Permission to Speak, or even my stand-up. I'm going to be in Edmonton in May, and also at the House of Comedy, and also at the House of Comedy in Arizona in May. So hope to see you out there. Enjoy the conversation with Kyle and Joshua. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Very excited to have my guests on today. Kyle MacLachlan, Golden Globe winning actor, best known for his collaborations with David Lynch, great filmmaker, and such
vehicles as Twin Peaks and the film Blue Velvet. He's also known for his work in Sex and the City and the film Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And then Josh Davis, a journalist, filmmaker, assistant professor of journalism at San Francisco State University. And Josh has received Peabody's and Emmy Awards for his great work producing social justice documentaries for Vice News, New York Times, NPR. Great to have you on the show, guys.
Great. I haven't done any of those things. I have not won Emmys or Peabody.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I am an investigative journalist.
My goal is to sort of create a wedge between the two of you through jealousy. So yeah. I hope I was able to do that.
We've already done it. We've been there and back.
Yeah, that's true.
I heard that.
We've crossed the jealousy chasm.
You have this really terrific podcast, Varnamtown, which we're going to focus on in this conversation. But let's back up a little bit. It focuses on Pablo Escobar, the drug dealer, and you know, sort of how he's kind of infiltrated this town. But let's back up a minute. How did you come to sort of work together on this? I know, Kyle, you approached Josh on something on this, but sort of give us a little backstory, if you will.
I heard this story through my wife and a friend of a friend of hers about this. And I just got snippets, you know, a woman who had moved to Varnamtown, North Carolina. She was actually an organic soap tycoon, had moved there to retire and then had heard these stories about some of the local inhabitants. And she passed that on to my friend about this small town where she had moved that in the 80s. And this is a small coastal town in North Carolina of about 300 people. And in the 80s, they had done a deal. The town had done a deal with Pablo Escobar as an importation hub for drugs, for what he was smuggling into America. So marijuana, cocaine, crates, this kind of thing. And they brought the shipments in by sea and by air into this little community. And I said, that is crazy. How does that happen? How do you make that contact, first of all? And I said, I need to know more about this. I reached out to Josh, my friend Josh, and I said, what do you make of this?
And I said, it sounds like hope, you know, nonsense.
Yeah.
But digging into it a little further, we realized, no, in fact, there was a story here. We didn't know what the story was exactly, but it was enough to get our curiosity going to the point where we went there. We took a small crew and we went for about 6 days, and we interviewed people at length on both sides of the equation and came away with some really, I think, compelling stuff.
So when you started to sort of poke around, I would imagine you'd be met with resistance because as this is described, that there are vast amounts of wealth, cocaine pouring into this community. It's like, hey, just don't upset the oil, the apple cart. Was it tough to sort of break through that? I would imagine resistance of people talking and because they just would want, you know, just want you to leave sort of well enough alone.
I found that the people were pretty open. This had happened in the 80s, and I think there was some sense of, okay, Escobar's dead, and people felt safe enough to talk about it.
I think people felt not necessarily relief, but I think in some cases that was relief. I think in speaking with people who had tried, particularly I'm thinking of one of our characters, Roger Morton, who stood up against what was happening. And I think he felt like he had some potential support from us, or at least a forum to be able to speak about his experience and the frustration, which I think was still apparent, you know, decades later in his efforts to stop what was happening, what he saw as a negative influence on his community.
Well, that might be the most brave person in the history of mankind to push back on Pablo Escobar. Like, what? How does that guy even sort of not? How's he not swimming with the fishes, as they say?
I mean, we felt that way about a lot of people in this town. What? How? Why are they all still alive?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What is that? Why do you think that is? Because you just hear how brutal Escobar was, and why North? Why this town? Why this town? By the way, that's the other sort of follow up on that.
Well, it basically what happened was in the early '80s, the cartels were bringing the cocaine into South Florida primarily. Mm-hmm. That's the easiest place. It's the closest place.
Sure.
But then the DEA got wise to that, cracked down on Florida, and the cartels went looking for, they kind of learned their lesson. They realized that Miami, that whole area, has a lot of people in it. So maybe it would make sense to go somewhere where there aren't any people, where there aren't any prying eyes, that is rural, that is remote, ideally a very small community. And so Varnum Town recommends itself. There's only 300 people. And then the other element of it is their planes had a northern limit of essentially Varnum Town. If you were to draw a radius from Colombia, from Barranquilla, this is the northern limit of the plane that they were using. So it was a confluence of elements, the seclusion, the northernness, and the cocaine would come into this town and then be transshipped to the major cities on the eastern seaboard.
Amazing. And I would imagine too, you know, the drug dealers probably liked it, but those shipping, because, you know, you tend to get a lot of sun in South Florida and you don't want to get melanoma while you're smuggling drugs. So North Carolina was probably a little bit better for him. You know, sometimes they forget to put on suntan lotion. As you say this, I'm wondering if Varnum Town made, Varnum Town made like those tourism ads, but focused it on looking for a place to park your cocaine. Well, Varnum Town, I wonder if it was, because people had to know about it, right? I mean, you can't do that kind of
everybody on that scale. In Varnum Town knew.
But even in surrounding other parts of North Carolina, didn't like state authorities know that? I mean, how
they
do you move that amount?
Did.
And they did nothing about it or what?
Well, some of the authorities were corrupt, were being paid. Huh. Certainly law enforcement was. There were others, most notably Mike Easley, the prosecutor in the county. He was a young prosecutor, and he took it on. He decided to start prosecuting the smugglers. And based in part on the notoriety that he got from that, he built a pretty substantial political career and culminating in becoming the governor of North Carolina. Hmm.
And what kind of money are we talking about? Like what was funneling through that community that just in terms of, you know, order of magnitude?
Millions of dollars is what the reporting says.
Mm-hmm. Did it degrade the community and the quality of life there? Because, you know, you just had people between the debauchery of having access to this money and then all of these drugs floating into this, you know, funneling into this small community, some of which I know most of it was, you know, almost like a stopover for distribution around the country. But I would imagine there must have been a huge drug problem in Varnum Town as a result of this, no?
It depends who you ask. Depends who you ask. Kyle, like, what are the two sides?
Well, you have the people that are benefiting directly, and these are people that are basically the muscle that's moving the the drugs from the freighters that are anchored offshore into town with the help of the shrimp boats. This is the shrimping community in a very depressed economic state. So these boats were available, and they used them to shuttle the drugs off the boats into the town, in which they were loaded into trucks. It's another group of people loaded into trucks and then moved out from there to other cities on the eastern seaboard and further west. And so they were making bank when they were offloading, but you know, they weren't offloading every day, but they were making $5,000 to $10,000 a night, basically is what we heard. And that money, of course, was being used to all sorts of different, depending on the person that you talk to, either they were building a new house, they were, you know, buying toys, cars, you know, boats they could use. They were, and then also there was use. Yeah, certainly lots of use among the community. But this is a little community that is pretty isolated. And so the story of this didn't really stay close to home. Honestly, people didn't. They talked amongst themselves, but they didn't carry out from there. Until, you know, the DEA started to investigate.
And I would imagine some didn't want to say anything because they were embarrassed, and others didn't want to say anything because they were benefiting from it, right?
Yeah.
So when this got shut down, which I assume it had at some point, like, so did this sort of operation move to another area on the East Coast? Did it, like, sort of, how did this sort of play itself out, or has it?
Well, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know, depending on your position, the war on drugs did not succeed. We have not been able to stop the flow of drugs. We have not been able to stop people's desire to consume drugs. So yes, in Varnum Town, this particular episode had a pretty dramatic end, not in the way you might traditionally think narco trafficking stories end, with a lot of blood. This ended very differently, surprisingly amicably. And yet, you know, when we speak to the DEA, the DEA agent who was most responsible for this, and he looks back on his career, he says, we did not win the war. We did not stop the flow of drugs. So, when you step back from it all, it's kind of a Pyrrhic victory.
Yeah. What sort of, you started to research this, you hear about it, then you start to research it, but then you get on the ground and you start talking to people and really digging in. Like anything in life, you go in with preconceived notions of what it's going to be like or what you're going to find, but what really surprised you in sort of once you started digging into this?
I think that for me, I mean, Kyle, you may feel something different, but it was the amicability of everybody, the fact that everybody got along still, that everybody spoke well of each other despite this very intense, difficult period of time.
When you say each other, just to clarify, you mean sort of neighbors within the community, some of which were involved in this and some weren't. They would just go to the local bar and chit chat and hang out and throw darts and not mention that, Joe Smith, his neighbors got 4 bales of coke weed or, you know.
Yeah, no, they will mention it. That's the thing. They will talk about it, even if they disagree about it. Even if they disagree, they'll still talk about it.
So how do they rationalize it to each other? How do they rationalize it to each other?
You know, I think that the community, when this all started, was so depressed, and so it was, you know, this is not a bustling, you know, successful town as much as it is a collection of people that have known each other for generations. These families go back, and so there's a sense of, you know, whether it's the South or this particular town, there's a sense of we're in this together, kind of, and that you really do depend on your neighbor. You rely on your neighbor in this small town. And so I think they all saw this as an opportunity. Many people saw this as an opportunity to like improve their situation, and they took advantage of it. And many of them, you know, paid a price for that. And over time, I think, because it's been a few decades, you sort of, I guess, bury any animosity that you might have had or differences of opinions, and you kind of recognize what it was at the time. And you're at the end of the day, you're faced with, you're living with the same people and you rely on them. So you somehow find a common ground.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what happened.
Yeah. They probably feel like, you know, that the system maybe has screwed me and I'm going to get mine and that kind of thing too. Right. A little bit like sort of, you know, everybody's doing something a little shady. Why not me too? There's a lot of ways you can rationalize something like that, I guess. And when you say they paid the price, yeah, like in what way? Like some people went to jail, or just some people like became, you know, slaves to drugs themselves, drug abuse. Like how did that manifest itself?
I think everybody came through it in their own way. There were definitely people who went to jail and people that had to come to terms with their use, you know. But at the end of the day, it seemed that they came together as a community again, which I think both Josh and I were surprised about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, I didn't know anything about this until this was, you know, brought to me, and it's so glad you guys are doing this. The podcast is Barnum Town. You're on podcast one, correct? As your sort of launching pad.
Okay.
Yeah. And people can get it wherever you can get podcasts. But thanks for doing this. It's really great. And are you guys working on any other projects together that sort of focus on things similar to this? I mean, not maybe, you know, drug smuggling, but do you have other projects in terms of investigative journalism that you're working on together?
As soon as we get off this call, we're gonna talk about where we're headed next.
All right, good.
Yes, we are, Jack.
Good. All right. Well, just don't fight over who has awards and who doesn't. That's just going to really create a lot of problems for you guys.
Okay. you're planting the seed.
I'm evil. It's great to have you on. It's Barnum Town is a podcast. Kyle McLaughlin, Josh Davis. Congratulations and best of luck. Thanks for being on.
Thanks so much,
Paul. Appreciate it.
All right, there you go. Very cool story. I love stuff like this. I just had no idea this even happened and existed. Hope you guys liked it. PaulMercurio.com, at Paul Mercurio, as you know. See what I'm doing out there on the road. Come see a show. And hope you all stay well, and we'll see you next week, everybody.